From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. At the Supreme Court today, history once again. Justices ruling 5-4 against the Trump administration's attempt to overturn the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, saying the decision to end the Obama-era program, known as DACA, was arbitrary and capricious.
Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the four liberal justices on this, and their decision means that DACA recipients can continue to stay in the country for now. About 700,000 people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children are actively enrolled in DACA. That allows them to legally work here and protects them from deportation. Joining us now is one of them, Reyna Montoya, a DACA recipient and founder and CEO of Aliento, an immigrant aid group in Phoenix. Reyna, thanks for joining us. And how are you feeling about this decision?
I feel very overwhelmed, if I can be very honest. My hands are still shaking right now, and they're sweaty. I think that we've been waiting for this decision for so long. So there's a lot of mixed emotions at this moment.
Well, and as a DACA recipient yourself, this obviously applies to you. What does this mean for you?
It means that I can catch my breath again and live with a little bit of peace that as of now I am protected, but I also feel really worried about what the future holds, since the Trump administration can decide to now follow all the steps and end the program. So definitely it's a very bittersweet victory, knowing that, okay, for today I am fine, but I don't know if I will continue to be fine tomorrow or whenever the Trump administration decides to do something differently.
Do you think that the Trump administration will continue to try and get rid of DACA?
I do. There's nothing that doesn't say otherwise. I hope and I pray that he would act something differently. But at the end of the day, I know that he decided to end the program on September 5th of 2017. So there's no any other data that can let me know that he won't.
Mm-hmm. Now, this program means that you are protected from deportation and that you can work in the United States. What about a path to citizenship? Are you optimistic that you will eventually have that?
That is my hope. I think right now it is really up to Congress, specifically the Senate, to come up with a nonpartisan solution that will protect Dreamers. There's been poll after poll showing that close to 90% of the American public, of U.S. citizens, want us to stay here, want a pathway for citizenship for us. So then my plea to Congress is to stop playing politics. The House already put a proposal forward. If the Senate does not like that proposal, they have the power to legislate. That's why that they were elected. We hope that they would legislate and finally give us a pathway to citizenship so we don't have to continuously to live in this uncertain legal limbo.
And give us a sense of your personal story. How did you come to the United States?
Yes, I ended up coming to the United States after escaping violence in Mexico. I was originally born in Tijuana, and my dad unfortunately was victim of state crime. He was kidnapped by Mexican police, and out of that, you know, we were so afraid about what could happen. He luckily was released, and we ended up doing an internal migration. We went from Tijuana to Nogales, another city in Mexico. But every time my dad would see a police officer, he was so worried about what that would mean, since he had received a lot of death threats, not only for him, but for my family. So he made the courageous decision to migrate to Mesa, Arizona, where he was able to buy a home, and I grew up. I went to junior high school in there, graduated with honors, and eventually went to university. I am an alumna from Arizona State University, Grand Canyon University, with a master's degree, and then I have an executive program from Harvard. So I think for me, it's been like, how to continue to endure all this trauma that has been created, not only by the unjust immigration system, but my own family trauma about what do you do when you're being threatened? And now that I am in legal limbo, you know, it's so heavy because the consequences for me are higher. Me going back to Mexico can potentially mean that I get kidnapped, that I get killed, and that definitely is something that keeps me late at night.
That is Reyna Montoya, who is a DACA recipient and founder and CEO of Aliento, an immigrant aid group in Phoenix, reacting to today's decision from the Supreme Court. Reyna, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Well, this ruling is the second Supreme Court blow to the Trump White House this week. On Monday, Justices Roberts and Gorsuch sided with liberals, saying it's illegal to fire people because they're gay or transgender. And then yesterday, there was that anvil of a tell-all book from former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton, dropping in media reports, including an interview on ABC. ABC's political director Rick Klein is here. And Rick, start with the court rulings. A president who presumably planned to boast to supporters in the upcoming rally and election that he filled the courts with conservatives, but two big losses. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a strange situation for him because on one level, you're right, this could demoralize supporters who've been so proud of these picks. And it's kind of strange for the president to have these blows dealt to him, basically citing him for a lack of competent governance, among other things. On the other hand, did he really want to deport hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants, the dreamers, right before the election? Did he really want gay people to allow to be fired? He doesn't, I think, personally care that much about these social issues. And it may be that he dodged some legislative and legal bullets here. And he can now turn this into a rallying cry. He's tweeting this just this morning. As I'm sure you've seen, that maybe mm-hmm. the courts have it out against Donald Trump. And I'd imagine he turns it into a different rallying cry at the rally tomorrow.
Yeah, well, apparently everybody has it out for him, including John Bolton. And let's take that up. The president is also threatening legal action to prevent his former national security advisor, John Bolton, from publishing that tell-all book, The Room Where It Happened. It's supposed to be released to the public Tuesday, but the cat way out of the bag with interviews. He characterizes the president as ill-informed, driven almost exclusively by his desire for re-election, easily influenced by dictators. Here's your colleague, Martha Raddatz. The full interview is going to air Sunday night.
How would you describe Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin?
I think Putin thinks he can play him like a fiddle. I think Putin is smart, tough. I think he sees that he's not faced with a serious adversary here. I don't think he's worried about Donald Trump.
Well, and should Donald Trump be worried about the book?
Well, I think this kind of judgment from a former national security advisor is almost without precedent. While the president is still in office, to say that he is unfit for office and to catalog confirmation, in essence, of the charges that brought the impeachment inquiry and a roughly similar situation regarding China, it is damning. It is devastating. The president has weathered plenty of books before by people like James Comey all the way through Omarosa. But what makes this maybe different is the timing. And to have this now dovetail with Joe Biden's messaging about the president being unprepared for crises as played out with COVID-19 and this tense moment around race relations, it challenges the president in a fundamental way. And he is out there tarring John Bolton, saying he's a liar and made things up and is out for profit motives. But he's going to have to answer for lots of specifics here, as well as the general sense that a growing number of even Republicans will say that this president just doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, some of the allegations, the president didn't know that Finland isn't part of Russia. But you mentioned China. Apparently, according to Bolton, Trump pleaded with Chinese leader Xi to help him win re-election by buying lots of stuff from American farmers. And this is from a president who was impeached, although not removed from office, but impeached for inappropriate relationships with a foreign leader. But that, Rick, didn't matter to his base or fervent Republican backers like Jim Jordan. Are you hearing that any of this matters?
I don't think it's surprising to people that were inclined to not believe the president anyway. I think where it has the greater impact is in the cumulative efforts of so many folks to draw on the shortcomings of this White House. And you have a Republican group out there that's been trolling the president with ads in Washington and elsewhere, questioning his fitness for office. I don't think that John Bolton or really anyone is capable of a mass defection among the Trump base. But for lots of voters who might have questions about his readiness or maybe just be weary of the drama surrounding Donald Trump, John Bolton offers an important piece of evidence from somewhere who literally was in that room when it happened.
Although a lot of people are saying, why didn't he testify during Trump's impeachment hearings? That sits there as well. But before we let you go in about the minute we have, the president said yesterday the virus is dying out, meaning the coronavirus, on a day when 23 states are seeing spikes. Look, we're not hearing the task force briefings. Anthony Fauci said he talked to Trump 2 weeks ago. You've got Vice President Pence writing an editorial saying things are fine. Are people in the White House just dismissing coronavirus?
They truly are. And all the way through the rally this weekend in Tulsa, Oklahoma, it is almost as if the White House wants to pretend like this isn't the threat that it is. And I think when you look at the facts, we know that there are a surge in cases in some places. We know that even some Republican governors are recognizing that this is a dangerous, perilous time. People like Anthony Fauci saying maybe it wouldn't be a great idea to go ahead with this rally. It is a major gamble by this president on public health grounds as well as political grounds to go ahead with this. And yeah, to pretend like we are already out of the woods when we're clearly not.
ABC political director Rick Klein. Rick, again, Martha Raddatz's interview with John Bolton Sunday night. Thanks so much for your time now.
Hey, thank you, Robin.
This Saturday in Tulsa, President Trump will hold his first political rally in months. There was criticism of the original rally date, tomorrow, Juneteenth, the holiday that celebrates blacks' emancipation from slavery. The president moved the rally to Saturday, but many are still upset, not least because it could lead to a spike in COVID-19 infections. Let's hear two views on this, starting with Reverend Robert Turner, pastor at the Vernon African Methodist Episcopal Church in Tulsa. Pastor, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And what do you think about the president's decision to hold his rally in Tulsa on Saturday?
Well, I really cannot express how disgusted I am and definitely was when he first announced coming here on Juneteenth. I'm happy to hear that he changed the date to Saturday, but still that's during our weekend of celebration. And as the president, I think that he knows, and he's a smart enough politician to know that when he comes to a place, he takes all the oxygen out of the room and all the attention focuses on him. And so now, instead of talking about the celebration of black liberation from slavery, chattel slavery, we're talking about the president's visit. And instead of talking about how we still have inequities and disparities in this country, as it relates to African Americans, we're talking about the president's visit. And I think that this was very disrespectful on his behalf to come during this time of celebration and remembrance and reflection. But also on just a general level, looking at the state of this country and the number of mass protests that we've had in virtually every state of the union, people demanding change. I mean, we don't need more campaign speeches. We definitely don't need a candidate Trump. We need a President Trump, and we need him to lead and take action. And I would hope that he would spend more time being the president now versus trying to be a candidate.
What about the fact that this first rally after months of no rallies is going to be in Tulsa, the site of a terrible massacre of African Americans in 1921? Your church, the Vernon AME, was the only structure to survive the whites' torching of the Greenwood District, which people called Black Wall Street at the time. The fact that he moved it from Juneteenth to the 20th is one thing, but do you think there's something wrong inherently with the president holding a rally at this time in Tulsa?
Absolutely. Tulsa is sacred ground. Tulsa is a crime scene. It has the worst massacre in American history. The first time airplanes were used to drop bombs or terrorize American soil. Not 9/11, not Pearl Harbor, but right here. And we still have yet to file one arrest to the white perpetrators who did it. And they were deputized by the sheriff's department, you know. And the fire department put out not one fire. The National Guard watched people's bodies be transported on the beds of pickup trucks. And for him to come in as though all is right with the world, unless he is bringing the Department of Justice with him or the Attorney General with him to investigate, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors, murders and felons, I think that, you know, he really ought to rethink the reasoning for his visit. Unless he's willing to come here and say he supports reparations for those of us who did not receive one insurance claim paid, I think he really needs to rethink his reasoning for coming.
Are you nervous about any potential violence between the people who are going to be attending the Trump rally and the people who are going to be celebrating Juneteenth?
I don't worry. That's something that preachers try not to do, but I am concerned. I am concerned a lot because his crowd has shown itself to be very aggressive, if not just outright belligerent, toward people of differing viewpoints. And he, according recently to his past rallies when he ran for president, he incites violence. He tells people, you know, back in the old days, we had a way of handling folks like that, you know, and then telling one of the crowd members that, you know, if somebody were to knock him in the jaw, I'm paraphrasing, you know, he would take care of the legal fees. I mean, who does that? Who says that in a presidential speech? And so we hope that he keeps his crowd calm. We know that white supremacists, neo-Confederates, neo-Nazis, they love him. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they came to the rally. And we are very much so concerned about that population. We know that's the same population that went to Charlottesville and ran cars through peaceful protesters. And so we are very much so concerned about that, but we don't operate in fear. As a man of faith, I don't move in fear. And I know and I trust and I believe that God will, as he always has, will continue to take care of us.
That is Pastor Robert Turner, who leads the Vernon AME Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Pastor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And now let's get another view. Don Burdick is a local energy businessman in Tulsa, also the former chair of the Tulsa County Republican Party. Don Burdick, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, and you think this rally should go on. Tell us why.
Yeah, of course. We have the sitting president of the United States who wants to come to the middle of the country, to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and bring his message to all the people. You know, that should be celebrated in America, frankly, even if people disagree. And I think it's fantastic to be here. And to be honest, it's been an interesting reaction, and I think exposed some of the hypocrisy and frankly, I'm just comforted by this, but some hateful speech towards him from the left. And so that's, I guess, to get that exposed for all to see is a good thing.
What do you mean hypocrisy from the left?
Hypocrisy from the left, sure. The concerns that emerged about a gathering of this size, because now it is a rally for the president, as opposed to concerns for other rallies that we've seen across the country in the last few weeks.
You mean because of concerns about spreading COVID-19 at a large gathering of people? Although some public health experts have said that there is a major difference between people being outside and people being inside, and this rally is going to be inside.
Well, there's a component of it that's inside, but there have been, again, I think a number of rallies, and the concerns being expressed about the virus have not really been a component of the conversation, but they are now. So it's unfortunate, but again, I think everyone can see that and judge what they will about whether or not it's appropriate now versus what it was a few weeks ago.
What about the concerns that our former guest, Pastor Turner, was bringing up? He said he was disgusted at the idea that in the midst of this movement from coast to coast about racial injustice and police brutality, that the president would go to the site of one of the worst instances of violence by white people against black people in our country's history.
Well, that's honestly, that is probably being spoken by someone who doesn't like President Trump in the base case. Okay, so it's politicizing it. We have on Juneteenth, Al Sharpton is coming to Tulsa. Now, Al Sharpton is not a bastion of political correctness, let's say. I mean, he said some pretty vile things. And you know, I refer to that House Resolution 270 in March of 2000 that condemned his racist and anti-Semitic views that he had ushered. So there's a gentleman who has a very clear history of racial animus, and he's coming to Tulsa to celebrate on Friday at the Juneteenth. So I political opponents are going to say what they're going to say, but I don't think it's appropriate and I don't think it's accurate.
Well, do you think that President Trump has a very clear history of racial animus?
Not at all. In fact, you know, I think part of the reason, look, I'm a Republican. I've seen every Republican since the 1960s be accused of being a racist. They did it to Ronald Reagan, George Bush, et cetera, et cetera. And it didn't stick to Donald Trump for a really simple reason. His television show that people had watched before he entered politics, and he had a simple message with The Apprentice. It was, I don't care if you're gay or straight, black or white, male or female, if you are the best, you are promoted and rewarded. And if you don't do your job, his famous line was, you're fired. So that message to the American people was clear. This is a man who really didn't see color, didn't see sex, didn't see any of the things that prohibited someone from being their best. And when they tried to level this charge against him that, once again, he's a Republican and a racist, it didn't stick because it's not true.
I'm sure that our listeners are screaming at the radio saying, well, why don't you ask him, what about when President Trump said with the looting starts, the shooting starts? Or why don't you ask him about the time that President Trump said that President Obama wasn't born in the United States and all that? I'm not going to do that right now because we just don't have time. But what I will ask you is, do you think it's possible that just because of your different life experience from our former guest, the pastor, that maybe you don't understand what this means to him, and that to African Americans in Tulsa, this might mean a lot more than you think it does?
You know, if we go down the path that unless you've completely walked in another person's shoes, you can't understand them, then we'll never be able to understand each other on anything because we each have had an individual path. I think that's destructive. I think if we can work together, we can make our country greater. But if we're going to simply throw stones at each other or just fight on political battles, we'll never make our country better. We've got to do better than that.
That is Don Burdick, who is a local energy businessman in Tulsa and former chairman of the Republican Party there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Jeremy.
And your thoughts on this weekend's Trump rally in Oklahoma are welcome at hereandnow.org. More food companies are rethinking their brands as others discontinue their brands that perpetuate racist stereotypes.
Your kids will love Aunt Jemima's light and fluffy homemade taste. Aunt Jemima frozen pancakes, because great days always start with a good breakfast.
Yesterday, Quaker Oats announced it is dropping Aunt Jemima, the 130-year-old pancake mix and syrup brand. Now three other brands, Uncle Ben's Rice, Mrs. Butterworth Syrup, and Cream of Wheat Porridge, could all follow suit. Let's talk more about this with Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, packaging for Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben's, and Cream of Wheat all feature images of black characters, which companies now admit is problematic. What's the historic significance of these characters?
Well, they're all a little bit different. The current criticism of all of them is that they reinforce stereotypes. In none of these cases are the people depicted the actual people who are being talked about. So there's no Uncle Ben on Uncle Ben's. There's no Aunt Jemima on Aunt Jemima. But, you know, black men have often been referred to as either boy or uncle to avoid calling them Mister. This is something that started during the Jim Crow era. Uncle Ben is supposedly a Texas farmer who was famed for his rice, but the character is not actually that person. It's a waiter from a restaurant in Chicago. So that's one piece of criticism. Aunt Jemima syrup, it's named after a minstrel song, Old Aunt Jemima. But again, the character who it's supposed to depict is a woman named Nancy Green, a formerly enslaved woman who became the face of the product back in 1890. So they have actually had to deal with this before. And the same thing with Cream of Wheat. It's a beaming, very happy African-American man in a white chef's uniform. In fact, the character was named Rastus, which is a pejorative term for a black man. It was actually once depicted as a barely literate cook who didn't even know what nutrition was about. So there's a sense that the reinforcement of the stereotype is something that brands are now reevaluating.
By the way, when it comes to Mrs. Butterworth, that doesn't feature an image of a black character, but the shape of the bottle is what's under review.
Yes, it's sort of a mammy, racial, nanny sort of character, a large African-American woman, at least the way people have stereotypically depicted that. And that's the feeling that gives people a lot of discomfort with it. Why are you shaping a bottle after a stereotype? So it's all of these things that some people might even call microaggressions. They're not really about real people, but it's appropriative because it's sort of signifying a stereotype of these people as cooks, preparers of your food. And on the other hand, they're not really real authentic stories. So these companies have all struggled with this over the last decade or so, but it's now coming into the fore.
And what does it mean for their business, and how will consumers respond if they make these changes?
So generally speaking, we've seen this, whether it's with racial issues or with guns, there's initially a bit of a pushback from people who think that this is political correctness run amok and they aren't going to buy the products. But in all of these cases, including Dick's Sporting Goods, by the way, which decided to stop selling long guns, they've made up for it with people who are sort of more interested in the progress and development that these things represent. In most cases, companies do rebrandings anyway, and we don't even notice them. The problem in these cases is when you do one as a result of a political climate, there are people who think you've been silenced or you've been forced into it by activists. Generally speaking, it's not expected that any of these kinds of changes will have a negative impact on these companies. We'll just see a new box, which is something we're used to seeing anyway.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
And you've no doubt heard about the death of federal security guard David Patrick Underwood, killed last month in a drive-by shooting while guarding a federal building in Oakland, blocks from the Black Lives Matter protest. Law and Order conservatives seized on his death as an example of violence from protesters or the anti-fascist group Antifa. But this week, a white, active-duty member of the military with ties to a far-right anti-government network called the Boogaloo Movement was charged with Underwood's murder. The suspect, Stephen Carrillo, is also charged with killing another officer who came to arrest him for the Underwood killing. And he's part of a wave of right-wing extremists openly saying they're taking advantage of this protest moment to fan unrest. Armed counter-protesters have been showing up at police violence protests. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, on Monday, a protester was shot, and a militia called the New Mexico Civil Guard is now under scrutiny by police, who, it should be noted, in many cases are trying to protect protesters from these far right-wing extremists and protect themselves as well. Let's unpack all of this with Ben Collins, who covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. Hi, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
And start with what the FBI is saying about Stephen Carrillo, active duty Air Force at Travis Air Force Base, a member of the Boogaloo. We've done reporting on the Boogaloo movement. We'll link you to it. They would like to see not just a race war, but they want to kill police.
Right. A lot of these people want to see a civil war, regardless of if it's a race war or not. They are anti-government extremists that, you know, in some cases, it doesn't have to do with race at all. In some cases, it has to do with what they view to be government overreach in general. For example, Carrillo here, a week after he killed that federal officer, he killed another police officer in an ambush. He actually shot two police officers. And before he was apprehended, he wrote on the hood of a car, Boog, which is short for Boogaloo. And he also wrote this other phrase that is tied to this man from 2004, who they called the Killdozer, who mowed down literally an entire town, 13 buildings, over a zoning ordinance. He has become sort of a hero in that movement. So that is sort of separate of race. Now, you know, racism plays a huge part into it. You don't relitigate the Civil War unless you want a different outcome. If you want a different outcome in the Civil War, you still have slavery. So it takes a bunch of anti-government factions all throughout the internet, and it gives them basically, it's a cute-sounding name, which allows it to look like it's been defanged, but really it's more dangerous than ever.
Yeah, and by the way, the phrase that Carrillo wrote on his car that referenced that other man was, "I became unreasonable." We know that his wife committed suicide a few years ago. His lawyer says that he hasn't recovered from that.
Yeah, you know, really, this is a tale of a man who was radicalized on the internet in every way. He found his accomplice, this guy named Robert Justice, in a Boogaloo Facebook group, and he said to him, you know, It's time to go. We have mobs of angry people to use to our advantage. He's talking about protesters at these Black Lives Matter protests. He's trying to radicalize those people into a fight with the police.
By the way, you mentioned Facebook. Facebook told you at NBC News that they have taken these groups off algorithms. So in other words, they may not recommend this group to you. Oh, thank you. But they're not going to take them off Facebook?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, we asked them about this actually a couple of weeks ago. We asked them about this before these things took place. In Las Vegas, three other people who identified as part of the Boogaloo movement said they were going to do basically the same thing in Las Vegas. They had, you know, cache of weapons, cache of explosives. One of them had posts on Facebook saying he wanted to basically foment the race war right now. So we asked them about that, and they said, look, you know, we're keeping this on the site, but we're going to take it away from the recommendations algorithm, which sounds like nothing, but in a lot of these instances, people were starting off in libertarian groups or Tea Party groups or gun groups, and they were finding their way just through that little thing on the right sidebar on Facebook, finding their way into these extremist Boogaloo groups, and then over the course of a month, they may have been radicalized. That may have been what happened here. And you know what? This isn't a censorship issue necessarily. They take down every ISIS post that has ever existed before we even see it. So there is sort of a double standard here that has not really been accounted for.
Mm. Well, we're reading story after story of armed militias showing up at protests, gunmen taking rooftop positions at a march in the small town of Omak, Washington. This week in Troy, New York, police say they arrested heavily armed men and found in one of their vehicles a militia manual for the New England Minutemen militia. Are they part of Boogaloo? Or are they? Who are they?
All of these groups, they could be part of a Boogaloo movement. This is more of like an ethos than it is a strict group of people. It's not like the KKK. It's not like a group that meets up and they all wear the same clothes, although they are starting to do that. They're all starting to wear Hawaiian shirts as part of a long-running gag they have. But they are feeding off an already existing ecosystem of anti-government extremism and white power. So, for example, in New Mexico, where there was that shooting at a protest a couple days ago, that militia in New Mexico, their leader pledged sort of allegiance to the Boog movement beforehand. It's those sorts of groups, it's three percenters, it's all of these groups, sovereign citizens, that have been around for years and years. And now they have a unifying force, right? They have just a standard term that they can use on Facebook and all these other places as a signifier, as a way to say, hey, look, I'm part of this group.
We are reading about the tiny town of Bethel, Ohio, about 2,800 people. 80 or so of them were having a Black Lives Matter protest on Sunday when over 700 counter-protesters showed up. These are motorcycle gangs, Back the Blue supporters. It's one thing to have people who support the police, but also people carrying rifles, bats, clubs. What is your sense of how dangerous this is? Because we know that President Trump has positioned the left or members of Antifa as fomenting violence, but NPR and other news agencies have looked at arrest records. Most of the people arrested for any kind of violence in all of these protests are local. They don't have ties to Antifa. What is the sense of how much danger is being presented by these militias on the right?
So we did the story about Klamath Falls in Oregon last week, how these local towns hear of these buses full of Antifa coming from people like their local sheriff, for example. And they will spread these rumors by word of mouth in real life and on Facebook and on Nextdoor. And by the end of the day, you have dozens of armed people around a county courthouse or something and no one for them to fight. And they don't take that as, you know, we may have gotten this wrong. Our information ecosystem is bad. We need some more local news. They take it as we fought off these people. You know, they'll come back one day.
Ben Collins, again, you and your colleagues have been terrific in covering this story of disinformation and extremism. But just wondering, there's another disturbing storyline, nooses that have been found in Harlem, in Birmingham, Alabama. And then two men found hanging in Southern California. Their families absolutely think they were lynched. Officials first said suicide in both cases, and now they're taking a closer look. Do you see anything in your research of these right-wing militia groups that would say that this would be something they would start doing?
You know, I don't want to make any accusations. I will say it would be sort of out of keeping with the Boogaloo movement, who is really singularly focused on carrying out at least fictionalized war against the government to create a second society. So this would be an incredibly drastic step by somebody in that movement. I really can't envision it. But, you know, these people are trying to start something. They have manifestos that are built on the idea of victimizing non-white people. I don't want to rule anything out, but I don't know enough. I will say that I have... a few weeks ago, I called Facebook. And I said, look, I hate being right about this stuff. If you guys don't step up, you and YouTube specifically, if you guys don't step up here, it's going to get really bad really quickly. And they didn't. It is, it's devastating to consistently know what's next in this beat. I'm sorry for talking like this, but it's a recurring nightmare that you just get used to, unfortunately.
Well, maybe getting it out there might reduce the possibility. Ben Collins, who covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC, will link you to his reporting for NBCNews.com at hereandnow.org. Ben, thank you so much.
Yeah, sure thing.
So let's listen again, hereandnow.org.
Because of COVID-19, Fashion Week is going virtual this summer. Digital Fashion Weeks for London, Milan, and Paris will be held this month and next month. Hannah Marriott is fashion editor at The Guardian. She joins us now from just outside London. Hi, Hannah.
Hi there.
So how does a digital Fashion Week work exactly?
Well, that's a very good question, because I think nobody really knows yet. It's such a change for the industry. The industry has been so rooted in this quite old-fashioned system of, you know, real-life shows. And for that to just suddenly end is, you know, really quite a seismic change for fashion. And even though we all live on the internet and it's, you know, such a major part of all of our lives, it hasn't been so far as easy to replicate the fashion show experience online. London has already had its digital fashion week, and it got quite mixed reviews, actually. There were some really brilliant, sort of innovative, collaborative and thoughtful projects, but actually there weren't really any clothes on show, or very minimal clothes on show, because the other part of the industry that's been completely upended by COVID-19 is production. And so a lot of people couldn't actually produce their collections in lockdown. So it became a sort of cultural platform with lots of talks and films and that kind of thing. On the other hand, a brand called Hanifa, which is a Congolese brand, you know, much more sort of independent than the big sort of London Fashion Week banner, did a fashion show about a month ago now. And it was absolutely spectacularly brilliant. I think partially because the designer had been working on digital catwalks before now, whereas a lot of these brands are looking at these issues for the first time.
So what do you mean by digital catwalk? How does that work exactly?
Well, Really interestingly, a digital catwalk could mean almost anything. In theory, it could mean virtual models walking down a virtual catwalk, you know, complete avatars. Or it could mean, you know, for some people, a fashion film could be, more of a standard film, one model walking through a catwalk, but you haven't got the audience there, so you haven't got the sort of social distancing problem. Or it could even be something even more high tech. You know, people have been talking about virtual reality as something that looks like it might happen maybe by September. So it's kind of, there's such a broad range of sort of options and ideas. For a lot of it, the tech is kind of in its infancy and we're still at a sort of experimental stage.
Well, fashion shows can cost millions of dollars to put together. I imagine a virtual fashion show would cut the cost down pretty significantly.
Completely. And that's what I thought was so great about, if we compare one other digital fashion show that's happened, actually, is Chanel Cruise. Obviously, Chanel is an iconic brand, very deep pockets, you know, they have access to the best of the best. And actually, their fashion show kind of felt a bit like it was just like a normal film. And what I thought was really interesting was with Hanifa's show, she must have had a fraction of Chanel's budget, but the digital format enabled her to innovate. And so she had this sort of really 3D looking kind of like statuesque. And so I think that's a really great thing, actually, is that fashion houses are going to have to stop doing fashion shows anyway, because they're all in the red because of the pandemic and they're looking for ways to cut budget. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, I really hope that this might level the playing field a bit, and people who couldn't afford to show at the traditional fashion weeks might get a chance to make a splash online through virtue of their creativity rather mm-hmm. than their budgets.
Now, the industry overall is worth something like $2.5 trillion in global revenue. I remember living in New York when fashion show would happen. It was a big deal. Lots of people coming in from out of town. It obviously has an impact not just on the fashion industry, but also on the city that's hosting it. So what kind of impact do you think we'll see financially from what's happening right now?
Yeah, I think in terms of sort of the absence of the whole circus of Fashion Week, you know, we know that that's going to be at least for the rest of the year, I would say, that that's not going to be happening, you know, very possibly longer. It's all the hotels, it's all the drivers, it's all the security guards, it's all the restaurants, you know, there definitely will be a huge economic impact. And then, of course, there's fashion, which is in this sort of enforced pause, where, you know, people, there's a problem with both supply and demand. You know, in some cases, they're still not able to access certain materials, but they're also, there's this massive pause on consumption in that all of us aren't doing the things we usually do over summer that make us buy clothes, like go to the mm-hmm. office, go on holiday. You know, from sort of both ends, the fashion industry is just, it's completely been turned upside down.
Well, do you think that the rebound will happen within the next year? Do you think people will be rushing to go out and buy things that will allow them to look as good as they want to look?
I don't think so. I don't think it will be within the next year. I know Chanel's CEO said today they think the impact's going to be felt for at least a couple of years. So earlier this week, British shops were opened up again, you know, real life shops, and you saw these queues outside various shops. And I think there will be that initial excitement, and we've seen that in different cities, but it just seems to be leveling off at the moment without anything to dress up for. I just can't see why, I just cannot see it recovering to anywhere near the level that we're used to seeing.
That is Hannah Marriott, who is the fashion editor at The Guardian. The fashion industry is going digital for fashion weeks this summer. Hannah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.